Chapter 9. Mr. Tickle displayed his newly invented spectacles, which enabled the wearer to discern, in very bright colors, objects at a great distance, and render them wholly blind to those immediately before him. It was, he said, a most valuable and useful invention, based strictly upon the principle of the human eye. The president required some information upon this point. He had yet to learn that the human eye was remarkable for the peculiarities of which the honorable gentleman had spoken. Mr. Tickle was rather astonished to hear this, when the president could not fail to be aware that a large number of most excellent persons and great statesmen could see, with the naked eye, most marvelous horrors on West India plantations, while they could discern nothing whatever in the interior of Manchester cotton mills. He must know, too, with what quickness of perception most people could discover their neighbors' faults, and how very blind they were to their own. If the president differed from the great majority of men in this respect, his eye was a defective one, and it was to assist his vision that these glasses were made. Mr. Blank exhibited a model of a fashionable annual, composed of copper plates, gold leaf, and silk boards, and worked entirely by milk and water. Mr. Prosy, after examining the machine, declared it to be so ingeniously composed that he was wholly unable to discover how it went on at all. Mr. Blank. Nobody can, and that is the beauty of it. Section C. Anatomy and Medicine. Bar Room, Black Boy and Stomachache. President Dr. Seemup. Vice President Smessers. Pestle and Mortar. Dr. Grummidge stated to the section a most interesting case of monomania, and described the course of treatment he had pursued with perfect success. The patient was a married lady in the middle rank of life, who, having seen another lady at an evening party in a full suit of pearls, was suddenly seized with a desire to possess a similar equipment, although her husband's finances were by no means equal to the necessary outlay. Finding her wish ungratified, she fell sick, and the symptoms soon became so alarming that Dr. Grummidge was called in. At this period the prominent tokens of the disorder were sullenness, a total indisposition to perform domestic duties, great peevishness, and extreme languor, except when pearls were mentioned, at which times the pulse quickened, the eyes grew brighter, the pupils dilated, and the patient, after various incoherent exclamations, burst into a passion of tears, and exclaimed that nobody cared for her, and that she wished herself dead. Finding that the patient's appetite was affected in the presence of company, he began by ordering a total abstinence from all stimulants, and forbidding any sustenance but weak gruel. He then took 20 ounces of blood, applied a blister under each ear, one upon the chest, and another on the back. Having done which, and administered 5 grains of calomel, he left the patient to her repose. The next day she was somewhat low, but decidedly better, and all appearances of irritation were removed. The next day she improved still further, and on the next again. On the fourth there was some appearance of a return of the old symptoms, which no sooner developed themselves, than he administered another dose of calomel, and left strict orders that, unless a decidedly favorable change occurred within 2 hours, the patient's head should be immediately shaved to the very last curl. From that moment she began to mend, and, in less than 24 hours was perfectly restored. She did not now betray the least emotion at the sight, or mention of pearls or any other ornaments. She was cheerful and good-humored, and a most beneficial change had been effected in her whole temperament and condition. Mr. Pipkin, M.R.C.S., read a short, but most interesting communication in which he sought to prove the complete belief of Sir William Courtenay, otherwise Thorne, recently shot at Canterbury, in the homeopathic system. The section would bear in mind that one of the homeopathic doctrines was that infinitesimal doses of any medicine which would occasion the disease under which the patient labored, supposing him to be in a healthy state, would cure it. Now, it was a remarkable circumstance proved in the evidence, that the deceased Thorne employed a woman to follow him about all day with a pail of water, assuring her that one drop, a purely homeopathic remedy, the section would observe, placed upon his tongue, after death, would restore him. What was the obvious inference? That Thorne, who was marching and counter-marching in osier beds, and other swampy places, was impressed with a presentiment that he should be drowned, in which case, had his instructions been complied with, he could not fail to have been brought to life again instantly by his own prescription. As it was, if this woman, or any other person, had administered an infinitesimal dose of lead and gunpowder immediately after he fell, he would have recovered forthwith. But unhappily the woman concerned did not possess the power of reasoning by analogy, or carrying out a principle, and thus the unfortunate gentleman had been sacrificed to the ignorance of the peasantry. Section D Statistics. Outhouse, Black Boy and Stomachache. President, Mr. Slug. Vice President, Smess. Notes and Styles. Mr. Quackley stated the result of some most ingenious statistical inquiries relative to the difference between the value of the qualification of several members of Parliament as published to the world, and its real nature and amount. After reminding the section that every member of Parliament for a town or borough was supposed to possess a clear freehold estate of £300 per annum, the honorable gentleman excited great amusement and laughter by stating the exact amount of freehold property possessed by a column of legislators, in which he had included himself. It appeared from this table that the amount of such income possessed by each was £0, 0 shillings, and 0 pence, yielding an average of the same. Great laughter. It was pretty well known that there were accommodating gentlemen in the habit of furnishing new members with temporary qualifications, to the ownership of which they swore solemnly, of course, as a mere matter of form. He argued from these data that it was wholly unnecessary for members of Parliament to possess any property at all, especially as when they had none the public could get them so much cheaper. Supplementary Section, Eumbiology and Dichwatterisics. President, Mr. Grubb. Vice President, Smess. Dull and Dummy. A paper was read by the secretary descriptive of a bay pony with one eye, which had been seen by the author standing in a butcher's cart at the corner of Newgate Market. The communication described the author of the paper as having, in the prosecution of a mercantile pursuit, bedeckened himself one Saturday morning last summer from Somers Town to Cheapside, in the course of which expedition he had beheld the extraordinary appearance above described. The pony had one distinct eye, and it had been pointed out to him by his friend Captain Blunderbur, of the Horse Marines, who assisted the author in his search, that whenever he winked this eye he whisked his tail, possibly, to drive the flies off, but that he always winked and whisked at the same time. The animal was lean, spavined, and tottering, and the author proposed to constitute it of the family of Fit for Doxmatorius. It certainly did occur to him that there was no case on record of a pony with one clearly defined and distinct organ of vision, winking, and whisking at the same moment. Mr. Q. J. Snuffletoffle had heard of a pony winking his eye, and likewise of a pony whisking his tail, but whether they were two ponies, or the same pony, he could not undertake positively to say. At all events, he was acquainted with no authenticated instance of a simultaneous winking and whisking, and he really could not but doubt the existence of such a marvelous pony in opposition to all those natural laws by which ponies were governed. Referring, however, to the mere question of his one organ of vision, might he suggest the possibility of this pony having been literally half asleep at the time he was seen, and having closed only one eye? The president observed that, whether the pony was half asleep or fast asleep, there could be no doubt that the association was wide awake, and therefore that they had better get the business over and go to dinner. He had certainly never seen anything analogous to this pony, but he was not prepared to doubt its existence. for he had seen many queer ponies in his time, though he did not pretend to have seen any more remarkable donkeys than the other gentlemen around him. Professor John Ketch was then called upon to exhibit the skull of the late Mr. Greenacre, which he produced from a blue bag, remarking, on being invited to make any observations, that occurred to him, that he'd pounded as that irrespectable section had never seen a more gamer cove nor he was. A most animated discussion upon this interesting relic ensued, and some difference of opinion arising respecting the real character of the deceased gentleman, Mr. Blubb delivered a lecture upon the cranium before him, clearly showing that Mr. Greenacre possessed the organ of destructiveness to a most unusual extent, with a most remarkable development of the organ of carvativeness. Sir Hookham Snivy was proceeding to combat this opinion, when Professor Ketch suddenly interrupted the proceedings by exclaiming, with great excitement of manner, "Walker! The President begged to call the learned gentleman to order." Professor Ketch: "Order be blowed. You've got the wrong un, I tell you. It ain't no Ed at all. It's a coker nut as my brother-in-law has been a carvin' to ornament his new baked tatter stall what's a coming down here vile associations in the town. Hand over, will you?" With these words, Professor Ketch hastily repossessed himself of the cocoa nut, and drew forth the skull, in mistake for which he had exhibited it. A most interesting conversation ensued, but as there appeared some doubt ultimately, whether the skull was Mr. Greenacre's, or a hospital patient's, or a pauper's, or a man's, or a woman's, or a monkey's, no particular result was obtained. Apostrophe, I cannot, apostrophe says our talented correspondent in conclusion, I cannot close my account of these gigantic researches, and sublime and noble triumphs without repeating a bon mot of Professor Woodensconce's, which shows how the greatest minds may occasionally unbend when truth can be presented to listening ears, clothed in an attractive and playful form. I was standing by, when, after a week of feasting and feeding, that learned gentleman, accompanied by the whole body of wonderful men, entered the hall yesterday, where a sumptuous dinner was prepared, where the richest wine sparkled on the board, and fat bucks propitiatory sacrifices to learning sent forth their savory odors. "Ah," said Professor Woodensconce, rubbing his hands, "this is what we meet for. This is what inspires us. This is what keeps us together, and beckons us onward. This is the spread of science, and a glorious spread it is. Apostrophe, the pantomime of life. Before we plunge headlong into this paper, let us at once confess to a fondness for pantomimes, to a gentle sympathy with clowns and pantaloons, to an unqualified admiration of harlequins and columbines, to a chaste delight in every action of their brief existence, varied and many-colored as those actions are, and inconsistent though they occasionally be with those rigid and formal rules of propriety which regulate the proceedings of meaner and less comprehensive minds. We revel in pantomimes, not because they dazzle one's eyes with tinsel and gold leaf, not because they present to us, once again, the well-beloved chalked faces and goggle eyes of our childhood. Not even because, like Christmas Day, and Twelfth Night, and Shrove Tuesday, and one's own birthday, they come to us, but once a year, our attachment is founded on a graver and a very different reason. A pantomime is to us a mirror of life. Nay, more, we maintain that it is so to audiences generally, although they are not aware of it, and that this very circumstance is the secret cause of their amusement and delight. Let us take a slight example. The scene is a street. An elderly gentleman, with a large face and strongly marked features, appears. His countenance beams with a sunny smile, and a perpetual dimple is on his broad, red cheek. He is evidently an opulent elderly gentleman, comfortable in circumstances, and well-to-do in the world. He is not unmindful of the adornment of his person, for he is richly, not to say gaudily, dressed, and that he indulges to a reasonable extent in the pleasures of the table, may be inferred from the joyous and oily manner in which he rubs his stomach, by way of informing the audience that he is going home to dinner. In the fullness of his heart, in the fancied security of wealth, in the possession and enjoyment of all the good things of life, the elderly gentleman suddenly loses his footing and stumbles. How the audience roar! He is set upon by a noisy and officious crowd, who buffet and cuff him unmercifully. They scream with delight. Every time the elderly gentleman struggles to get up, his relentless persecutors knock him down again. The spectators are convulsed with merriment. And when at last the elderly gentleman does get up, and staggers away, despoiled of hat, wig, and clothing, himself battered to pieces, and his watch and money gone, they are exhausted with laughter, and express their merriment and admiration in rounds of applause. Is this like life? Change the scene to any real street, to the stock exchange, or the city bankers, the merchant's counting house, or even the tradesman's shop. See any one of these men fall, the more suddenly, and the nearer the zenith of his pride and riches, the better. What a wild halo is raised over his prostrate carcass by the shouting mob. How they whoop and yell as he lies humbled beneath them. Mark how eagerly they set upon him when he is down, and how they mock and deride him as he slinks away. Why, it is the pantomime to the very letter. Of all the pantomimic dramatis personae, we consider the pantaloon the most worthless and debauched. Independent of the dislike one naturally feels at seeing a gentleman of his years engaged in pursuits highly unbecoming his gravity and time of life, we cannot conceal from ourselves the fact that he is a treacherous, worldly-minded old villain, constantly enticing his younger companion, the clown, into acts of fraud or petty larceny, and generally standing aside to watch the result of the enterprise. If it be successful, he never forgets to return for his share of the spoil, but if it turn out a failure, he generally retires with remarkable caution and expedition, and keeps carefully aloof until the affair is blown over. His amorous propensities, too, are eminently disagreeable, and his mode of addressing ladies in the open street at noonday is downright improper, being usually neither more nor less than a perceptible tickling of the aforesaid ladies in the waist, after committing which, he starts back, manifestly ashamed, as well he may be, of his own indecorum and temerity, continuing, nevertheless, to ogle and beckon to them from a distance in a very unpleasant and immoral manner. Is there any man who cannot count a dozen pantaloons in his own social circle? Is there any man who has not seen them swarming at the west end of the town on a sunshiny day or a summer's evening, going through the last-named pantomimic feats with as much licorice energy, and as total an absence of reserve, as if they were on the very stage itself? We can tell upon our fingers a dozen pantaloons of our acquaintance at this moment, capital pantaloons, who have been performing all kinds of strange freaks. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.